The second case for oral argument this morning is Union Pacific Railroad Company, appellant versus Lloyd's of London, appellees. For the appellants, we have Mr. Richard Gray, an attorney from Chicago. Is that correct, sir?
It is, Your Honor.
Very well. And also Mr. Arlo Somerville, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the Appalachian Continental Casualty, we have Mr. Charles Thompson, an attorney from Pierre, and Ms. Alicia Barton, an attorney from Dallas, Texas. Correct? Now, my understanding is that, Mr. Gray, you'll be presenting this morning for the appellants.
I will, yes.
Okay, and then Mr. Thompson, you will take 16 minutes and go first, and then Ms. Barton will take 4 minutes. Is that correct? Okay. Then Mr. Gray will have the rebuttal time. Very well. Mr. Gray, you may proceed, sir, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Judge. It is an honor for me to be here. May it please the court. This is an insurance coverage dispute regarding the environmental cleanup of the former Chicago and Northwestern Railroad Roundhouse facility in Huron, South Dakota. On summary judgment, the trial court found that the insured, the Chicago and Northwestern, forfeited all of its continental insurance coverage for which CNNW had paid approximately $1 million on or before 1967, $1 million that Continental has had the use of for over 40 years. The trial court held forfeiture because it found that CNNW had failed to give timely notice of loss, even though the policies set no time limit for the giving of notice of loss. The trial court held forfeiture without inquiring whether Continental had been prejudiced in any way as a result of CNNW's allegedly late notice. Because the insured committed no breach of the notice of loss provision, this court respectfully should reverse. If choice of law needs to be reached, this case raises a very significant choice of law issue. It's the issue of whether the well-settled law of South Dakota, requiring that insurers prove prejudice from an alleged lack of notice, whether that law must yield to the laws of foreign jurisdictions that have a contrary rule.
So was there ever notice?
Yes, ma'am, there was.
And what did that consist of?
It consisted of notice of, it is not, the notice provision itself or the notice letter, Your Honor, is not a matter of record before you, but it was given in it was given prior to June of 1999, Your Honor.
Well, if you say it's not a matter of record, I'm having trouble because, frankly, I came in here with the understanding that other than the filing of the complaint, there had never been a notice given.
No, there was a notice filed, Your Honor.
And that is out of record somehow?
Is that a dispute that they received that letter at that time?
I don't believe that there is, Judge. Not as to notice of loss. No, I do not believe it is.
Now, when does that coincide within the time that you had the all of the cleanup had been finished?
There was still some cleanup ongoing, but a substantial amount of the cleanup had been concluded
on
at
June
that point
of 1999.
That's when the complaint was filed, Judge, and I know the notice was prior to the filing of the complaint. Yes, ma'am. Notice was given. The question is not whether notice was given. The question is whether notice was late. And the language of the policy is clear in stating that, quote, the insured shall give written notice to the company of any loss, close quote. On its face, there's no time limitation on the giving of notice of loss. South Dakota and Illinois both say that the contract language of the policy controls. The insurer says that this language was the subject of negotiation. We agree. This omission of a time limit is not a mistake. It's been repeated three times in the three policies that are the subject matter of this dispute. South Dakota and Illinois law both say that the language, if this language is used as a forfeiture provision, which is exactly what's happening here, because of late notice, we were summary judgment out and gave up our coverage with regard to Huron, then even though it might be subject to negotiation, if it's used as forfeiture, it is to be construed against the insurer. There should be no after-the-fact reading of a time limitation on notice of loss. The trial court should not have reformed the contract to make it something that it is not. There's no need to decide when the timing of notice of loss is reasonable, where the policy notice of loss provision contains no time limitation on the giving of notice.
Mr. Gray, you know, we have a rule of construction that we follow in this jurisdiction that says you don't interpret contracts to reach an absurd result. And frankly, to suggest that there's no limitation whatsoever on filing notice of loss seems to be absurd, especially in view of the provision that proof of loss has to be given as soon as practical. It would seem to me that if proof of loss has to be given as soon as practical, notice of loss has to come at some point before that.
Well, Your Honor, when I say that there is no notice of loss giving time limitation in the policy, I mean that. It's not an absurd result, respectfully, because obviously you've got to give both notice of loss to the insurer, and you've got to give them a proof of loss as well, or you're never going to get paid as the insured.
But so, would you agree with me that if you have to give proof of loss as soon as practical, you've got to give notice of loss at some point before that?
You have to give notice of loss, I would suggest, Judge, at least no later than the time that you give proof of loss, because proof of loss is different from notice of loss.
So we do have some limitation here. We at least have the contract language as soon as practical.
As soon as practicable, Judge, that's right with regard to proof of loss. But respectfully, what Judge Erickson did here was to merge the two. And as a consequence of that...
But don't you have to merge the two?
No, Your Honor.
Because you just conceded that you got to give notice of loss before you give proof of loss.
No, Your Honor. Excuse me, but I'm sorry. I don't mean to argue. Notice of loss, I think, can be given as late as the time for the proof of loss.
So that still brings us back to as soon as practical.
It does, Your Honor.
So we have a limitation.
We have a limitation on the giving of proof of loss. That's right. But that isn't necessarily... If you construe and need to construe, and our position in this case is we don't have to get to that issue because there's been a waiver by the insurer in reserving its proof of loss objection. And we also have our anticipatory repudiation point on that as well. But put those aside so that I can address your question directly. Proof of loss and what is as soon as practicable for that, it seems to me, can be far different from just notice of the fact that there is any loss. You've got to incur some loss. You've got to have some idea of the quantification of loss. You've got to figure out what it is exactly you're spending this on. I mean, it's more akin, Judge, to a proof of claim that perhaps we're more familiar with than an automobile accident setting or something like that. And then, so one of the major points, Your Honor, is that Judge Erickson merged these two concepts together, proof of loss and, notice of loss and proof of loss. And I think what we're entitled to, and I'm going to argue ultimately that a jury ought to be entitled to consider, is whether the only real issue of time limitation, proof of loss as soon as practicable, uninfluenced by notice of loss, was met. And we submit that it was. But we think that's a genuine issue of fact for the Trier effect. What we're trying to do here is set the contract on the right footing by first acknowledging that as to notice of loss, there is no time limitation. Then we can deal with proof of loss, and I think we ought to deal with that on its own footing.
So you're still arguing there's no time limit on giving notice of loss?
No, I didn't say that. There is a time limit on the, I'm sorry, Judge. I misheard you. I am saying that there is no contractual time limit as a matter of the contract that both these parties negotiated on the giving of notice of loss, other than the very practical one of you have to give notice of loss, and you have to give then proof of loss, could be at the same time as soon as practical, or you're not going to get paid under the policy. So it's not like you can go for never. You have to give it at some point in time, but there is no contractual limitation on when that should be given.
So, Mr. Gray, when would be the time that your client had actual knowledge that there was going to be a claim against Continental?
Well, Your Honor, I think that that certainly preceded the filing of the complaint in 1999. They, as the record shows, had information from the EPA that this was going to be a site of some significance, and they certainly anticipated, I think it's fair to say, they certainly anticipated that this could be a site that, that would impact the policy.
So what would be the earliest date?
The earliest date for notice?
For knowledge.
Your Honor, probably about 18 months before the notice of loss was given, because that's when they impacted the coverage. This coverage has a $500,000 deductible, self-insured retention. That's the point at which I think they went over $500,000 in expenditures. Now, once we deal with notice of loss and move to proof of loss, then, again, we have the waiver argument, which I'm not going to address further than in our briefs. But if Continental has not waived any objection to the timing of proof of loss, then the trial judge should have considered that timing of proof of loss separate and apart from notice of loss, because it's a separate analysis. As I was saying in answer to your question, Judge, the role of proof of loss is to identify and quantify what the insured has spent and on what. Therefore, what is as soon as practical for quantifying damage is, we submit, very different from just supplying notice of the facts of any loss. And if the proof of loss ground for forfeiture is to be considered independently, then CNNW should be given an opportunity to respond to that by supplementing this record and by addressing that before the judge, the trial judge, independently. But if proof of loss isn't waived and our anticipatory repudiation argument is rejected, then the issue of choice of law comes into this case. But going back to, Your Honor, your question of when it might be foreseeable and when notice ought to be given as a practical matter, irrespective of the legal obligation, I think it is very important to take into account the arguments that we make with regard to anticipatory repudiation, which speak to the issue of we've been down this road before. We, the same parties, have been in other disputes on similar insurance policies, and the record is replete with the testimony from the representatives of Union Pacific as the successor to CNNW about how this was an exercise that did not lead to a, you know, productive review, but rather was burdensome and really didn't get to the purpose of actually resolving the claim. Now, let me turn to the, and I'm sorry, Judge, and so the point of all that is that I think you have to look at the conduct of the parties, not in the isolation of this particular scenario, but in light of the interaction, the course of dealing, if you will, of the parties in previous situations dealing with insurance policy coverage of long-tail claims, which is what this this case is. All right, let me now speak to the choice of law issue as quickly as I can. There is no choice of law issue on contract construction, but there is a choice of law issue that arises if this court finds a CNNW breach of some obligation to the insurer. In that case, South Dakota law requires prejudice to the insurer. Without prejudice to the insurer under South Dakota law, then there is no violation. Now, choice of law in this contract is a matter of, in this jurisdiction, excuse me, is a matter of statute, and that's section 5314. And as this court held in Anderson versus Taurus, which we cite in our briefs, our first task is to determine where the contract was to be performed. The trial court did not do that. As the insurer acknowledges in its brief, the trial court went straight to the place of making. Had the trial court made the required examination of the policies to discern place of performance, it would have seen that the place of performance is South Dakota. Here's the evidence from the policy. The policy is written to the CNNW, a railroad with fixed trackage and fixed real property in South Dakota. The policy indemnifies CNNW against all third-party property losses, including third-party property in South Dakota. In the event, and I think this is very instructive, in the event of certain disputes arising under the policies, quote, an umpire shall be selected by a judge of a court of record in the state in which the property covered is located. The property here obviously is Huron, South Dakota. The judges that would make that assignment, as the parties agreed, would be a judge of this state. The policies also provide that any clause in the policy is superseded to the extent that it is inconsistent with any specific statutory provision in force in the state within which coverage is granted. Coverage is granted in Huron, South Dakota, as to that site, so the state, again, is South Dakota. These are all of record. It's all in Plaintiff's Exhibit C. I just took the first of the three policies, but all three of the policies have essentially the same language. Now, these policy clauses show that South Dakota is the place of performance to be gleaned from the contract. It was clearly foreseeable to the insurer, we submit, that these policies could be performed in South Dakota, and that is exactly what happened at Huron. Now, consistent with gleaning the place of performance from the policy, this court should apply, we suggest, the commonplace rule that in the case of an insurance policy, the place of performance is where the risk is located and the insurance proceeds will be put to use.
Now, you've got some of these policies that are in your table of your appendix here. Yeah, which one are we talking about? Can you give me a direction?
Sure. We are talking, Your Honor, about
there's
three.
One couple of them I can't hardly read.
Okay. Well, we've tried the best to get some of these older policies, Your Honor, but they are all contained. There are three policies. There's one that Judge Erickson refers to in his opinion that's not, even in his January 07 opinion, it's not one of the policies that's in this case. But the policies, if you look at the appellant's, excuse me, the appellee's brief, they are listed in the appendix, Judge. They are exhibits C, D, and E. Policy numbers are given. They're all Continental policies. C, D, and E in the appellee's brief.
Now, does it specifically address the site of the property that it's covering?
It does not, Judge.
Okay.
It does not say you're on South Dakota. But it does say all third-party property all property with covering risks of third-party property damage for all property of the Union Pacific, the CNNW Railway.
So does this, the C&W Railroad would have covered more than South Dakota?
It would indeed.
So are you in danger then of having differing opinions depending upon, or different applications of law depending upon where the claim was made as to the property damage?
Not necessarily where the claim was.
You have Illinois and South Dakota and wherever else it is. And
you certainly have the issue of different results. Yes, ma'am. But that is exactly what's contemplated by the statute when the first thing you look at is place of performance. The way to cure that would be to forget about place of performance, which we respectfully submit is exactly what Judge Erickson did, and just have a constant, singular rule that says place of making.
But and there's no language in any of these that indicate where what laws covers it.
There is no choice of law provision, no judge. But again, it seems to me the answer to your question is the only way to avoid different results where the risks are in different states is to rewrite the statute. And the statute says, no, the first priority is the place of performance. And that, in some of the other cases that we submit to you, show that that reflects the interest, really, that the case that the state has, in ensuring that insurers in its case, in its state, have the benefit of its states.
I see you've run out of time.
Yep, your time has expired.
Thank you,
Mr. Gray. Mr. Thompson, you have 16 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, Alicia Barton, my co-counsel, is with us, and she, as you mentioned, will make a few remarks and try to clean up for me. She prepared most of the brief and is very knowledgeable about the case. The railroad had a problem starting back in 1962, according to the record. In 1962, the city of Huron got on them about their pollution problems. In 1990, they started to establish reserves. The railroad started to establish reserves of $500,000 per year, which just happens to be the deductible on the Continental policies. In 1994, the EPA sent them notice of a potential liability, and in that letter, they said in so many words, by the way, tell your insurer. After that, in 1994 and 1995, they got bids. They got a cost estimate of up to $3.5 million. The EPA sent a consent to accept liability. They negotiated with EPA, they negotiated with DENR, they negotiated with the DM&E. And in 1996, they agreed with the EPA and entered into a consent order accepting liability. We have not been notified of anything up to that time. Not only official notice, we don't know anything about Huron. 1995 and 1996, they spent over $5 million. Again, we don't know anything about it. September 18th, 1997, we were finally sent notice by the railroad.
1997,
that's Exhibit O to Appellee's brief. In that notice, I'll get to that in a second. But in any event, the triggering events for notifying their insurance company, which had been their insurance company under this series of three policies since 1958, was 1962 when they first had problems with the city of Huron. That was 35 years before they gave notice. When they started to reserve under their own financial for a loss, up to the amount of the deductible, that was 7 years before they gave us notice. Or when the EPA gave them notice of potential liability, tell your insurance company, and that was 3.5 years before that they knew. Now, they did send...
The notice was so important. Why wasn't that put in the contract that it had, that notice had to be given or when it had to be given? I mean, this is... If it's open-ended like this, how can we read into something that's silent? It's silent. It's an insurance company. They've developed these, and there's no date or there's no timing. So why would we give them the benefit of the doubt? Why would you give your client that benefit?
For several reasons. One is that notice must be given sometime. There has to be a when, and there has to be a standard of reasonableness, and reasonableness runs all through our law.
Is that a jury question, then, and not a summary judgment issue?
No, it's a matter of law, and I believe Nugent versus Quam will give you some of the standards for that. Judge Erickson found that 3.5 years afterwards, after the site has been cleaned up, after it has been covered up, and the only thing left, in my memory of reading the record, are some monitoring wells, is not under any standard proper notice. It needs to be given in time that Continental can perform, investigate, confirm if there was a loss, the reasons for the loss. That was under the Manduca deposition, which is cited at Exhibit U of Appellee's brief, not to mention things like Continental needs to reserve the money for any future losses that they might have. Have they been prejudiced? Yes. Under Illinois law, however, we don't have to show that. Because, among other things, when we get notice after everything is covered up, we don't have the ability to travel back in time and see what was there, what the causes were, what needs to be done to remedy it. One of the justices, I think Justice Zinner, mentioned the proof of loss, which does say a time. I think that's interesting in that the proof of loss says as soon as practicable after the loss. We know the loss started in 1962. We know they knew about it then. They knew about it in 1990. They knew about it in 1994. As soon as practicable after the loss. The language of the proof of loss doesn't say as soon as practicable after the notice. It says as soon as practicable after the loss. So the standard of reasonableness, any standard of reasonableness, would be when the notice and the proof of loss should be given. Because obviously, giving either of those pieces of information to the contracting party on the other side is the same as receiving no notice and no proof of loss at all. That's what Judge Erickson found, that under any standard, whether it's Illinois law or South Dakota law, it was too little and too late. With regard to the choice of law matter, Judge Erickson looked at the policy. Exhibit C to our brief is one of the policies. That's the one that's the most readable. Paragraph 1 under general conditions, it says, where is it to be performed? Anywhere in the United States or Canada. The notice that came that we've just talked about as being Exhibit O says, Dear Continental, we've got problems in Michigan, Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, Minnesota, and South Dakota. That's what the notice says. Judge Erickson looked at that and went back to the Great West Casualty case. And the Great West Casualty case tells a trial court, how to determine whether a choice of law decision should be made and how to make it. Judge Erickson found that the contract was negotiated in Illinois, that it was delivered in Illinois, that the insurance agent who represented the railroad companies in trying to negotiate this matter along with them, Marsh McLennan, probably the biggest in the nation, was from Illinois. The railroad itself was in Illinois. Continental was in Illinois. And if Continental ever has to perform and actually pay money, they're going to take the check across the street from Continental's house to the railroad's house and pay it within Illinois.
Why does that trump the South Dakota statute?
Why does that trump the South Dakota statute?
How can you ignore the South Dakota statute?
I don't think we are, Your Honor. I'm missing your point. I apologize.
Well, the appellant argues that the South Dakota statute controls it, that it's where the site is of the loss, or the risk, I guess.
The South Dakota statute was applied in the Great West Casualty case. And the judge set very specific things that need to be found if there is no one site under one policy.
But in this case, there is one site.
There's six.
Being claimed.
There's six.
Okay, at the same time.
At the same time. Same notice. There's six.
You know, Great West, though, they really didn't anticipate a loss in, yeah, I think it was Texas or someplace like that. I mean, that was an accident, an auto accident. They weren't doing business. Well, I guess maybe a trucking firm might be argued to be doing business, but it was a fortuitous event, unlike this situation where you really know you've got a roundhouse and you got tracks and you're going to have potential claims. Does that distinguish the case?
Looking at the contract language, it simply says any place in the United States or Canada.
But it also doesn't have a choice of law in the contract.
It does not. And when the courts would look at that, I believe in almost any state, they would go back to Illinois in that situation for the reasons stated. The next thing that Mr. Gray mentioned was the contract itself and some presumption or a presumption against the insurer. Remember that this is a case that was, or this is a contract that was negotiated between titans of their respective industries. My client is a big outfit. The railroads are a huge outfit. The railroads are the railroads that connected the two oceans, that move all our farm products to the oceans, that move the goods back to us. They have enormous economic power. They're able to hire the finest legal talent that there is, and Richard Gray is number one in those. He's a fine, fine lawyer. But to favor one over the other in that type of a situation is to not promote fairness or justice, but actually to defeat it. If you look at the reason that this court has in many cases said we're going to construe things against the insurer, it's because it's John and Mary Smith of Crestbard against the huge insurance company, which has said, here's a policy. If you need insurance, this is it. You don't have any power to change anything. This is not the situation. If you look in the Manduca depositions, which I believe are attachment U to our brief, and the Harrison deposition, which I believe are attachment V, you will find that the contract was, in fact, negotiated. And where it's negotiated, to have any type of a presumption that one is more powerful than the other simply skews the law. Sometimes we need those presumptions for fairness. This is certainly not one of those. To say that Mr. Gray has black hair and therefore we should favor him kind of discriminates those of us who have gray hair, and probably he and I don't need that. But in any event, Your Honor, I believe, unless the court has other questions, that I'm going to finish.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
Thank you.
Ms. Barton, you have 4 minutes.
May it please the court. I just want to touch on a few points that Charlie also touched on and highlight. Now, with respect to the questions that were asserted as to the notice and the no timing requirement, the first portion of the notice provision provides that they must provide written notice of any loss. Loss is defined in all of the policies at issue as loss or series of losses or liability arising out of one occurrence. Based on that language, they had a duty to provide written notice of any liability arising out of one occurrence. Based on the fact that Charlie went through and in a brief, the liability goes back, it's clearly established before, but at no point I don't think it can be disputed when the EPA sends a notice in 1994 of potential liability and saying, please alert your insurance carriers. I think that's a starting date, most definitely. Subsequent to that notice, there was ongoing negotiations as to the consent order and which was later entered in 96, conceding to liability, and as agreed to by Union Pacific and CNNW. So I therefore do think there is a requirement that they had to provide written notice at that time. As to the proof of loss and the waiver issues that have been raised, the proof of loss language is included in the policies, which have clearly been attached and referenced in the briefs and motions. It was debated at length in the underlying case and also included in both orders granted by Judge Erickson. In addition, in the conditions precedent, in the affirmative defenses included in Continental's answer, clearly found that there was a clear pleading of that. It was completed with, it was pled with the specificity required by South Dakota statute. As to the issue of anticipatory repudiation, essentially CNNW is requiring that you look to cases not involving the contracts at issues, claims not involving necessarily the plaintiffs at issues. To do so goes against the law of anticipatory repudiation. At no time did Continental give any unequivocal intention that it was going to deny coverage under these policies. And in fact, upon receiving the written notice in 97, Continental almost immediately responded with a reservation of rights, not admitting or denying coverage and requesting additional information so that it could make a further coverage determination and as is allowed and as is Continental's right under the policies that were negotiated between these parties, both sophisticated and agreed to at arm's length bargaining. I think the judgment the order entered in the underlying court should be affirmed in its entirety, and the arguments raised as to anticipatory repudiation and waiver are essentially only to mislead the court from the clear and deliberate withholding of notice, which CNNW has clearly conceded to multiple times in oral arguments and swells and motions. The facts are undisputed here. The notice was not provided until 97. Therefore, any issues as to the reasonableness of the notice are a question of law for the court to decide and determine. And we think it's appropriate to do so to find that the notice was untimely as a matter of law.
Don't juries usually determine questions like reasonableness?
Generally, yes, but case law holds that as long as the facts are undisputed, that reasonableness of the notice and the timing of the notice is one for the judge to make. And here, CNNW has openly conceded that they deliberately withheld notice due to the paperwork and the burden it would prove for them to go into coverage. And my time is about up.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Barden.
Okay. Mr. Richards?
Oh, you wouldn't find your way out of the building without them. Mr. Gray, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the repudiation issue, the reason that the trial court decided that it wouldn't find anticipatory repudiation was that he declined to extend the doctrine to prior litigious conduct between the parties. And we cite, to your honors, not a South Dakota case, but a Florida case, the Nye case, which we think is very, very similar to this in the sense that the parties, an insurance carrier plus an insured, had disputes on multiple lead paint claims.
If the trial court hadn't done that, wouldn't it, in essence, force you to retry all these prior squabbles to a jury?
No, Your Honor, because I think the issue is simply one, if we're going to deal with it now on proof of loss, of whether it's reasonable, whether what was done is reasonable. And so I think that, with all respect to Appellee's counsel, is a question for the jury. So you don't have to retry it. You just have to take a look at what the impact of that would be on a reasonable person trying to make compliance on the next one.
Well, wouldn't that still require you to give some kind of notice written in some respect, even if it's an anticipatory repudiation? And don't you have to do something?
You have to do that the manner in which it is set out would necessarily, or not necessarily, but ought to be modified. But What happened here is we don't have an absence of notice, and we don't have an absence of proof of loss. If you look at several of the exhibits, which are part of Appellee's brief, you will see sworn testimony in deposition about what the plan was, how much money was being spent. And I'm not suggesting that that was real early on. I'm just suggesting that it does comply with the giving of proof of loss, and there is notice. So it's not whether you give notice, it's when, and there isn't a limit on when. And it's not whether you give proof of loss or not, it's whether you've given it as soon as practicable in the manner that we did it. And the question then becomes, we submit one for the jury to sort out that reasonableness question. Let me speak briefly to the...
Before you do that,
sure.
You want the jury to make that decision, but do you agree with opposing counsel that the facts regarding giving notice in this case are undisputed?
I'm not sure that the record is as fulsome on that, Judge, as it would be if we didn't have the problem of this misconstruction of the contract on notice. So my answer to that is no. I don't think that we're ready to concede that all of the facts, and I want to be careful here not to go outside the record, but I don't think on all the facts we can concede that that what is before the court now on proof of loss is the full story.
Well, what facts are in dispute?
Well, again, Your Honor, I'd be going outside the record. I'm happy to respond to your question by doing that. Yeah, when Union Pacific, as successor to the CNNW, got involved in these coverage disputes, it would do the following, Judge. At or about the time it filed the complaint, it would send the insurer, including Continental, a copy of the complaint. It would invite them to talk about it. It would set up a meeting, and again, I'm all outside the record here. But
then I'm going to stop you because I want to know what you told the trial court was a disputed fact in this case regarding notice.
With regard to notice of loss, I don't know that we did, other than to say this is when we gave notice and that was adequate.
What I'm asking is, did you make a record before the trial court that there are disputed issues of fact regarding the notice of loss that preclude judgment in this case?
I think we treated that, Your Honor, as a legal issue of what the contract requires. And as to that, there is at a minimum a disputed question of fact. And then again, if proof of loss is part of that, and it was because it was merged, then that's one where we want to make a more fulsome record. And we think it is an issue of reasonableness, as Your Honor pointed out, that goes to the jury. Let me speak very briefly to the presumption or weight and who you construe provisions against. This is, as I understand it, a policy that was negotiated. So this is not contra pro ferendum that we're talking about as the reason that my black hair ought to trump Charlie's gray hair. What we're really saying here is the law abhors a forfeiture. We have got a payment here in the amount of approximately $1 million, and basically in return for that, because we failed in Judge Erickson's eyes to give timely notice when we don't think that our notice wasn't timely because there wasn't any time limitation. And he sort of threw in, although it's not clear to me to what extent he reviewed the as soon as practicable issue about proof of loss, as he should have, in isolation. So it's the forfeiture that gives my client the benefit of the doubt, not contra pro ferenda.
Kind of along that line with the reasonableness of the notice, and just looking at the notice, was the notice 3.5 years after I heard that term or that number of years? Years after you had finished whatever, cleaning it up.
Your Honor, I think the record on that.
3.5 years after the site had been cleaned up.
The site had been substantially cleaned up, but there were still ongoing activities at the site, testing, pumping, that kind of thing. But in answer to another question, I think it was about 18 months before that $500,000 threshold was crossed. That happened 18 months before the notice of loss was given in this case.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right. On the Great Western, the Great West case, I think that there really isn't any question, if you look at the appellee's brief, that they concede that what Judge Erickson did was immediately go to the place of making. And that's not what the statute requires. The Anderson case makes it absolutely clear that his first duty was to look at the contract. The items that I read to you today are all items that came directly from the contract. And it was a fortuitous event in Great West. I mean, it was a truck accident that fortuitously took place on a Texas road. And in that case, this court could not discern from the contract a Texas place of performance. Here, the policies clearly insure a piece of real property, of a real railroad with real tracks that have been in this state since nearly the turn of the last century. Clearly, it was foreseeable for the insurer in the 1950s and 1960s to beware of the possibility of claims on risks that existed in this state. Finally, the decision in Great West, you know, has the result of applying this state's law, whereas what we're talking about here is a result that would cause this state's law of prejudice, which protects every insured in South Dakota who has a risk in South Dakota that he's insuring, protects them from forfeiture. And that should not be tossed away on a case where it is clear and foreseeable that there's a risk in the state that is the object of the coverage. And Great West doesn't require anything different. Okay. Unless you have questions, my time is nearly up.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gray.
Thank you.
The court should have noted at the commencement of the argument, just have your seat if you would, that this case was submitted at the time when Justice Sabers was still a member of the court. He disqualified himself, and thus the court appointed the Honorable Jack Von Wald, a presiding judge of the Fifth Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabers' place. Although Justice Sabers is now retired and Judge Severson has taken his place, the case was assigned before that took place. With that, we're in recess. Thank you.